This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Thanks for listening. Well, today, the politics and poetry of place. Could the democratic process be improved by allowing our elected officials to phone it in a little more instead of flying back and forth from Washington to their districts every week? We'll talk to one congressman who wants to change the fundamentals of casting a vote on the House floor. Hey, maybe we could even extend that idea to the ballot box. We've been asking you about that. To the poetry of place, a Takeaway listener brings us closer to her home in Palestine, Texas, as part of our This Is Where poetry project. But first, on the very day that President Obama starts a much-delayed trip to Asia, and that pivot to Asia the White House is talking about, we are going to start with what appears to be significant news from the Middle East. After meeting in Gaza, the three rival Palestinian factions, that's Fatah, Hamas, and Islamic Jihad, they've come to a new agreement. They say they're going to form a unity government together under the Palestinian Liberation Organization banner. Deals like this have been announced before. They've come to very little. This time, are things any different? Diana Boutu is a human rights attorney and former advisor for the Palestinian negotiating team. Diana, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course. Well, this isn't the first time that Fatah and Hamas have reached a power-sharing agreement. The other agreements haven't worked out. Is that right?
Yes, I believe this is about the seventh time that they've been promising they're going to enter into some sort of a power-sharing agreement, and neither of those agreements have ever worked out, in large part because of the pressure that is brought to bear on the Palestinian Authority, particularly financial pressure on the part of the Europeans and the Americans, who have always threatened to cut off aid if the two factions join forces.
We should probably repeat that the Palestinian Authority is the government in the West Bank, that Hamas is the government in the Gaza Strip, and those two factions have been at odds for quite a long time. So what does it mean now? Is there anything different, Diana Boutu, about this agreement that suggests it might be more concrete than the past efforts?
I'm not very optimistic, to be quite honest. Neither one of these factions is really coming forward and putting Palestinians first. In other words, they're talking about power sharing, and they're talking about which ministries they're going to handle and share and split. But at the end of the day, what they seem to ignore is that all of us are living under Israeli military rule, and none of them have come up with a strategy as to how they're going to address that military rule. And neither of them has indicated that they're going to actually uphold the human rights of Palestinians who have been quashed as a result of not only the split, but the ongoing negotiations with Israel.
And of course, there can't be a discussion of this agreement without a close discussion of Israel. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said earlier today that his negotiating partner, if you can even call it that, Abu Mazen, Abbas, was choosing to make peace with Hamas and not Israel, that you can't have both. It's either Hamas or it's Israel. How does one interpret that rhetoric from the Prime Minister of Israel?
Yeah, this is what Israel has been saying for a long period of time, placing it as though somehow there's an equation between choosing peace with Israel versus peace with Hamas. He hasn't given us peace with Israel. He hasn't actually ended the occupation. And again, I'm not very optimistic, but Netanyahu's statement simply shows exactly how farcical it is that Israel has been behaving over the course of the past 7 years during a period of this split.
Well, the latest round of negotiations between Abbas and Netanyahu have really gone nowhere, and there's a deadline at the end of the month. It's hard to imagine any agreement between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority making things any worse in terms of negotiations with Israel.
That's precisely right. The fact that they're now pointing to Hamas as being the excuse simply shows that Israel was never interested in peace in the first place.
Diana Boutu, of course, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has been in Israel and Palestine trying to restart negotiations between the sides. The U.S. is trying to sort of turn away from problems in the Middle East and highlight its pivot to Asia. I wonder if this new agreement draws Secretary Kerry back in to a negotiation, or if it's sort of business as usual for him.
I don't think that he is going to do anything when it comes to this agreement. The United States has already announced that there are some conditions in terms of recognizing this new Palestinian unity government. And it's, what's interesting about this is that these are conditions that the United States put into place back in 2006. So the fact that this Obama administration is following in the footsteps of the Bush administration indicates to me that they're simply not interested in pursuing this any further. This, for them, is the end of the road.
There's one view of a new deal between Hamas and the Palestinian Authority from Nazareth in the West Bank. That's Diana Boutu, human rights attorney and former advisor for the Palestinian negotiating team. Thank you, Diana.
Thank you.
And as that deal is unfolding in the Middle East, President Obama is in Tokyo today. It's the first stop on his week-long trip through Southeast Asia. At the top of the agenda are the rising tensions between Japan and China over a group of uninhabited tiny islands in the East China Sea known as the Senkaku Islands in Japan and as Diaoyu in China. Now, both countries have claimed the islands as their own. President Obama reaffirmed this week Japan's territorial claim in a written answer to the Yomiuri Shimbun newspaper, saying, quote, "We oppose any unilateral attempts to undermine Japan's administration of these islands," end quote. For more on the president's trip to Tokyo and the territorial tensions between China and Japan and some of the broader picture as well, we turn to Orville Schell. He's director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. Thanks for joining us, Orville.
Pleasure.
Orville, let's talk about the broader context of both the president's visit and the dispute between China and Japan here, because none of this, at least as far as the U.S. is concerned, is really about some tiny uninhabited islands. The president has to think strategically here, right?
Well, he's sort of flying right into the hornet's nest between the second and third largest economy, both of which are quite sort of irradiated at this point by nationalist sentiment, and both are claiming sovereign possession. So we have a treaty obligation to come to Japan's aid if it is attacked. However, we have not taken a position on who has sovereign possession of the islands, only recognizing that China has not been the administrator of them, that Japan has, and we have agreed that we would defend Japan's administrative right, but we're dodging the question of whose islands they actually are.
And at the same time, as you and I are talking about islands and whether we dodge the questions of who they belong to, the broader issue really is the rise of China in Southeast Asia, the critical strategic partnership between Japan and the United States, and our need to not offend the Chinese too much because they're such an important economic partner, but not let them walk all over an ally.
Well, this is precisely the dilemma that Obama is going to find himself in the middle of for the next few days. We certainly do need to maintain our alliance with Japan. On the other hand, we cannot but find ways to work with China on a whole host of questions.
And there are also a lot of political voices in Japan saying, oh, it's a matter of time before the United States kind of edges away from us and turns toward economic partnership with China. We're going to lose out here.
Well, and of course, they look at the Ukraine, where the United States has done very little to come to their defense. And they wonder whether this pivot to Asia that Obama has proclaimed is actually worth as much as they hoped it was.
Is it a fair criticism? You know, a lot of members of Congress, the president's opponents, and I guess a lot of people in Japan say exactly that. Look at Ukraine, how Vladimir Putin took Crimea and is now maybe going to take parts of eastern Ukraine. Look at Syria, where United States rhetoric didn't match up with action. They think that all of this is prelude to American acquiescence around these islands and in relation to China. Is it fair?
I don't think that criticism is fair because we do, after all, have the Seventh Fleet that stretches from Honolulu to Singapore. It's the most powerful fleet in the world. We do have a treaty obligation with Japan. We did not with Ukraine.
Well, at the same time, Orville Schell, you know, I read this statement that we mentioned at the top that the president gave to the Japanese newspaper. It's very carefully worded in diplomatic speak, as you'd expect. And it says that administration of the islands is covered under the treaty with Japan. But I noticed the last sentence, "and we oppose any unilateral attempts to undermine Japan's administration of these islands." It says oppose. It does not say the Seventh Fleet will launch cruise missiles if you take over the islands. I mean, I can oppose things in many ways.
Well, of course not, because this is where the balancing act comes in. The United States does, in the best of all possible worlds, to keep a somewhat neutral position in this.
Do the leaders in China get on notice when we want to put them on notice in this way? Are they amenable to these types of diplomatically balanced efforts?
They are tremendously sensitive to any sort of suggestion that they are being contained. And of course, the U.S.-Japan alliance just really makes them concerned that this is precisely what has happened, a kind of a post-Cold War recontainment of Asia, preventing China from taking its rightful place in Asia and the world as it rises. So this situation is open for a tremendous amount of misinterpretation.
Before we let you go, Orville Schell, what about the conversation in private between President Obama and Japanese Prime Minister Abe? I mean, I imagine it's a lot different than the public announcement. Doesn't the president have to tell Abe, look, we've got your back, stop provoking China and don't whip them up?
That's precisely what he will say. He will say, we are longtime allies. Please keep calm and cool. We do not want to get the Chinese any more exercise than necessary.
Orville Schell is director of the Center on U.S.-China Relations at the Asia Society. Thank you, Orville.
Pleasure.
In a moment, we're going to hear about one congressman's push to make voting easier for our elected representatives in Washington. Now, voting for the rest of us is getting harder in many states thanks to new restrictions in voter ID laws. But should we actually be trying to make it easier for all of us? And if not, why not? And if we should, then what's the one thing you'd want to see changed? We've started a lot of debate here.
My name is Kim. I'm calling from Maine, and I don't think that we have any need to make voting any easier than it is now. We need to keep the integrity in our voting process, and there have been way too many elections where fraud was not only accomplished but encouraged.
A lot of you agree with Kim from Beltsville, Maryland. I think it's pretty easy, but we should be making it more significant. People don't not vote because it's hard. They don't vote because they feel it doesn't matter.
This is Arthur from Palo Alto, California. I would make it easier to register to vote and to vote without onerous requirements. There's hardly any evidence of people illegally voting. But what I wouldn't do is allow voting on the internet or by smartphone. Criminals and foreign nationals can steal credit card numbers from Target, break into Google, and damage the website of the Secretary of State of Oregon. So why wouldn't they try to steal elections for pay?
Also on Facebook, we've got some great suggestions and comments, and thank you for those, including this from Brian Watson. He says, replace Election Day with Election Month. Give voters 30 days to retrieve a ballot, study each issue or candidate, talk to their friends and neighbors and family and coworkers, decide, and then deliver their ballot. Well, stay with us to hear how one congressman would change voting for members of Congress. He wants to be able to vote even if he's not in Washington. This is The Takeaway. Well, Congressman Eric Swalwell is a Democrat, and he represents parts of Silicon Valley in California. And when Congress is in session, Mr. Swalwell has a Monday morning routine. It goes like this. Swalwell and his Northern California colleagues arrive at San Francisco International Airport in time for a 6 a.m. flight across the country to Washington. With the 5 hours on the plane, he's lucky if he makes it to his D.C. office by rush hour and to the House floor for a usual 6:30 vote. It's a back and forth that members of Congress have always dealt with in some form or other and always complained about. Swalwell wants to change it, though. He's proposed a bill that would grant Congress the power to vote on legislation and even attend committee hearings remotely. Now, can you imagine lawmakers having a heated exchange over the attack on the American consulate in Benghazi over their iPads?
The fact is, we had four dead Americans. Was it because of a protest, or was it because of guys out for a walk one night who decided they'd go kill some Americans? What difference at this point does it make? It is our job to figure out what happened and do everything we can to prevent it from ever happening again, Senator.
All right, can you imagine this exchange taking place over Skype?
Have you no sense of decency, sir? At long last, have you left no sense of decency.
The McCarthy hearings of the communist witch hunt era there. Well, Congressman Eric Swalwell joins us now to talk about his idea. Welcome, Congressman.
Hi, Todd. How you doing?
I'm great, thanks. Look, you must be the only guy in Washington, though, who thinks that members of Congress should spend less time together in the jet age. I mean, everybody says that nobody gets along, nobody knows each other anymore because they're always on planes, they're always fundraising, they don't go to dinner anymore. Sounds like you want to make it worse.
What I want to do is make Congress better connected with the people that we serve and spend more meaningful time together. And technology, I believe, is the only way that we can do that. And my mobile Congress bill, which I introduced with Republican Congressman Steve Pierce, seeks to do just that.
So if it would allow members of Congress to attend committees remotely, let's say by something like Skype, a secure Skype, or even vote remotely in certain circumstances, how would that make Congress better? How would that bring lawmakers who are at war closer together?
Right now, what I've found, Todd, is we're flying back and forth every week, and I've done approximately 350,000 miles now. I go home almost every single weekend, except if there's business in Washington. And so we have these Monday night votes where I come in, and we're literally bringing 435 people across the country into the House chamber, and we're voting to allow the Capitol grounds to be used by the Boy Scouts, or we're naming a flight center. And so I started to look at the votes, and I saw 52% of the time we are voting on non-substantive suspension of the rules initiatives, legislation. So what I proposed is, why don't we take this non-substantive perfunctory work that we do and vote remotely on those items? And then let's take the real meat and potatoes, the budget, health care, energy, defense spending and cuts, the tough questions, the tough challenges that we face. Why don't we spend more time in the chamber dealing with those issues? And while I'm out in the district, I can bring up my phone and say, oh, yes, I do think that we should name the NASA Flight Center after Neil Armstrong, and click send and vote that way. And so I think it's just a way to bring Congress into the 21st century. I'm certainly not asking for us to work any less. When we're home in the district, we are going 24/7. I'm just saying, let's work more efficiently so that we have more meaningful time together in Washington and more efficient time to spend on these perfunctory tasks.
Yeah, you know as well as I do, around Capitol Hill, they call those perfunctory votes, those name the post office votes, they sometimes call those bed check votes on a Monday night. Get members to Washington to make sure that you all turn up. And isn't there a value to that? I mean, if you talk to the people who try to run the place, they lament the fact that you guys don't spend enough FaceTime together. You don't go out for those drinks anymore like you did in the older days, or go out to dinner, make friends with people on the other side of the aisle. And I wonder if being able to vote, even if it's on something unimportant like naming a post office or naming a NASA flight center, it'll make politicians more remote from one another.
Sure, Todd. And right now, just so you have an idea of what the schedule is, they call us the Tuesday-Thursday Club. And that's yeah. not a compliment. What it means is, you know, we get in, as you said, late Monday night. We leave early Thursday. So really Tuesday through Thursday, we're working. So under my proposal, we vote remotely on the non-substantive stuff. I'd happily be in Washington Monday through Friday, 2 to 3 weeks out of a month, and then spend the rest of the time in the district. But right now, it just, to me, we'll spend an hour debating, the budget. We'll get an hour of debate on the budget. That's it, 1 hour. And then we're flying in and doing 52% of the work on non-substantive naming post office-like work. So I'm actually proposing spend more time in Washington on meaningful legislation, and let's use the technology that the rest of the world is using to do their day-to-day business on more non-substantive tasks.
Hey, can you imagine some of history's most high-profile, memorable hearings having been done on a Skype screen? You know, like Joe McCarthy yelling at some proto-communist witness over a Skype screen, or Henry Waxman facing down Rafael Palmero, or something like that.
Yeah, and you know, with video conferencing and Skype, this isn't just for committee hearings that we're proposing to use it, because many times what we found is some of our colleagues, because of work life or family issues, can't always attend all of the hearings. I'll give you a perfect example. A couple of my colleagues have recently had children. And if you're a woman and you're serving in the Congress and you just had a child, you know, it's very tough. You want to be there for your child in those early months, and you're faced with the prospect of missing votes, missing committee hearings, or not being able to raise your child during those very formative times. And so if you could Skype in or remotely vote on some of these non-substantive bills that we take up, that member could still be productive, like that person would be able to do in the private sector. And I think it would just bring our institution up to speed. So I think it would be certainly more accommodating for women to serve in the Congress as well.
Eric Swalwell, Democrat from the East Bay in Silicon Valley in California, says, at least on some issues, let members of Congress vote by an app, by phone. That's his proposal.
There's an app for that.
Voting in Congress? There's an app for that. Forget about the voting card. Congressman, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, voting for lawmakers could be easier, but what about you? Could it be easier for you? Should it be? Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. You can tweet us at The Takeaway. A story now about the lines between American identity, citizenship, and the rights that go along with that citizenship. According to a lawsuit filed yesterday in federal court, the FBI has allegedly been coercing Muslims living in the United States to inform on other Muslims by using the nation's no-fly list as leverage. The suit was filed on behalf of four men in New York. The lawsuit accuses the United States of placing or keeping the men on the no-fly list after they refused to inform on other Muslims in New York and New Jersey and in Nebraska. The no-fly list, of course, you've heard of it, was created after the 9/11 attacks. It restricts travel for thousands of individuals into and out of the United States, and it's notoriously difficult to get your name off of it once you're on. Earlier, I spoke to Ramzi Qasim. He's an associate professor of law at the City University of New York. He's the supervisor of the CLEAR Project, that's Creating Law Enforcement Accountability and Responsibility. He also represents the plaintiffs in this lawsuit.
Some of our clients were approached, and the FBI attempted to recruit them as informants. Our clients declined for religious and political reasons. So those are First Amendment protected reasons. They declined to become informants, exercising their First Amendment rights. And in retaliation for their exercise of that right, the FBI then placed them on the no-fly list. And then the FBI agents circled back to our clients and said, well, if you had played nice, this might not have happened. And we can take you off, by the way, if you change your mind and you work for us as an informant.
We should say that the FBI has not responded to this lawsuit, has not commented on it publicly. One of the other problems, as you mentioned, Ramzi Qasim, is that the criteria for the no-fly list often remain secret. This is unlike sort of a negotiation that would go on between an accused and a prosecutor when you're charged with something to say, hey, we can give you a lesser charge kind of thing.
That's right. There's very little that is known about the standards which the U.S. government uses to administer the no-fly list. In the little that we do know publicly, one of the standards is for the person to be a known or suspected terrorist. Now, of course, we have no visibility into how the U.S. government interprets that standard. And then there's the larger question of whether they're even adhering to their own standard, because as we know from the police misconduct context or even from the stop and frisk context where, you know, reasonable suspicion is supposed to be the standard, the police often fails to apply that standard. And it's a huge problem here when you have no transparency, no accountability. There's no way for us on the outside, lawyers, interested citizens, journalists, to understand the standard and to verify independently whether the government is living up to that standard.
I'm trying to imagine the future of this case, Ramzi Qasim, and aren't you worried that the case could get thrown out of court because it might require the government to reveal classified information, i.e. how the no-fly list works and what the criteria are?
You know, we at CLEAR and our colleagues at the Center for Constitutional Rights have often litigated cases where the government comes into court and asserts so-called national security interests. But I cannot emphasize enough that this is simply not a national security case. This is a case about fundamental civil rights. It is about our clients' rights to speech, association, and religion under the First Amendment. And it's about our clients' right to due process of law. They should not be, the government should not be able to strip them of their freedom to travel without giving them notice and an opportunity to be heard. That's what this case is about. It is not about security. Our clients have never been accused of any crimes. They don't even have any criminal records.
Ramzi Qasim is an associate professor of law at the City University of New York and supervisor of the CLEAR Project. He also represents four plaintiffs in a new lawsuit accusing the FBI of using the no-fly list to coerce American Muslims to inform on some of their neighbors. Professor, thank you.
Thank you so much.
We'll be right back.
Well, Shakespeare has a lot to say about the stars.
Men at some time are masters of their fates. The fault, dear Brutus, is not in our stars, but in ourselves that we are underlings.
And the bard has plenty to say about the moon.
It is a very error of the moon. She comes more nearer Earth than she was wont and makes men mad.
And Shakespeare also writes about the sun.
Doubt thou the stars are fire? Doubt that the sun doth move? Doubt truth to be a liar? But never doubt I love.
Now here's a question. How much did the real science of astronomy influence Shakespeare's writing? It was just the early days of the scientific Copernican revolution, after all. But on what is now the bard's 450th birthday, we spoke to Dan Falk. He's author of the new book, The Science of Shakespeare. It examines the connections between the famous playwright and the beginnings of the scientific revolution.
In my book, of course, I talk about, you know, how much science we should read into Shakespeare's writings. But what you cannot really avoid is that there's a lot of talk about the sun and the moon and stars and even eclipses and meteors and comets. These are things that actually keep coming up throughout Shakespeare's work.
Now, one of the most important things about this interpretation, which is a lot of fun, is timing. What was going on in the universities of England and in Europe at the time of sort of the, you know, the Copernican revolution, right, in Europe, sort of set the scene for us about what was going on with astronomy that might have sort of straddled the time that Shakespeare was doing his work.
Yeah, absolutely. So with the advantage of hindsight, we look back and we can notice that Copernicus had published his revolutionary book describing a new idea that the Earth and the planets go around the sun rather than having everything go around the Earth. So that was published 20 years before Shakespeare was born. But nonetheless, the Copernican theory was being taught in some universities.
Well, what I'd like to talk about is some of the examples that you think you've come up with. There's one interpretation of Hamlet as sort of a cosmological allegory, and it's a stretch, but I found it fascinating. What's that one?
That's the work of Peter Usher. He's an astronomy professor, and he has this sort of elaborate theory that all the action in Hamlet is sort of an allegory for competing views of how one ought to interpret the cosmos.
Do you buy it?
I'm a bit skeptical of the allegory part. But the part where I think Peter Usher has done something very valuable is that it gets us looking at some of these connections. You know, did Shakespeare know about this new star that burst into the sky when Shakespeare was a young boy? So when Shakespeare is talking about the star westward from the pole in Hamlet, could that be a reference to the supernova? That, I think, is quite plausible.
Well, Dan Falk, it's a lot of fun to look back at Shakespeare through another eye or an eyepiece of a telescope, if you want. But it was still a world and a lot of plays that were woven through with fairies and magical thinking and bad luck. So we have to kind of take it with that. Shakespeare was still very much enamored with an unnatural world.
Well, I think the key here is that it was a transitional period. So you're absolutely right. You know, there was magic, there was astrology, there were people accusing each other of being witches. But at the same time, we can look at a play like King Lear and see sort of people appealing to the gods in vain. You know, we start to see some hint maybe of a godless world where it's up to human beings to decide their own fate. And actually, speaking of King Lear, there's a wonderful exchange between Gloucester and his illegitimate son Edmund, where Gloucester is going on about how these eclipses lately seen in the sun and moon portend no good. And Edmund turns to the audience and says the opposite of that, like, oh, come on. He calls it the excellent foppery of the world. You know, we blame all of our misfortunes on the stars. And I just see this little hint of Carl Sagan there. I mean, I'm exaggerating a little bit, but that's I think you can actually get a little taste of that in Shakespeare's later plays.
Dan Falk is author of The Science of Shakespeare. Dan Falk, thank you.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
On this Wednesday, we hear another bit of verse from one of you celebrating a special place, a plot of land connecting a family across generations.
This is where my mother is buried. This is where I will be buried too. In a family cemetery, on this land cleared and tamed and fenced by a child bride who celebrated her golden wedding anniversary before she lay down deep in the woods of East Texas, beneath the tall pines, punctuated by brilliant dogwoods, mere steps from the home she kept and swept, and where she slept, not forever, but just for the night, with the man who tamed the land with her, and oversaw the digging and the laying of the stone, who mows and tends this place alone, this place where my mother is buried.
That's takeaway listener Kathy Wells from Palestine, Texas. Her poem describes a cemetery deep in the woods of East Texas.
It's a very rural area, about 15 minutes from town by car. It's only accessible by a blacktop road, one lane. And there are many varieties of hardwood trees there. We have elms and sycamores and hickories and, of course, pine trees and dogwood trees. And when you're there at the cemetery, if you're very still, you can be very quiet and hear the birds and the leaves gently blowing in the wind and through the tall pine trees. You might hear some footsteps in the woods, deer or other animals. So it's a very nice and quiet, peaceful place.
It's a quiet and peaceful place that you have said you really want to tie in with your family. Now, your mother and father are the ones who sort of built this place, or at least got it intertwined with the family. And I take it that it's your intention to make those ties even deeper.
Yes. That, of course, is going to be where I will be buried. And there is a deep family connection there with my sisters also. And this is a place where when I go, I do feel very connected to my family and my mother's memory and memories of things that our family's done together and the times that we've spent together.
Your mother and father, at least at first, struggled financially and struggled to get this land. Can you describe that a little bit, sort of how they became intertwined with it? It was through a lot of work.
It was through a lot of work. My parents did grow up very poor. I grew up very poor, but my father was an oil field worker back in the late 70s, and when there was a oil boom in the Middle East, and he was able to make enough money working overseas that he was able to come back and actually plant some roots deep in Palestine and on this property and purchase it. But at the time they bought it, of course, it was just thick with underbrush and, you know, not developed or tamed at all. They did a lot of clearing and burning of brush and fencing, and there was a lot of hard work to actually make it a viable property.
Does the physical input into the land, the physical work that went into it from your parents, make it mean more to you? I mean, you mentioned it in your poem and you mentioned it here. I wonder if the actual hands-on and the burning of brush and the sweat and the dirt makes it mean more to you.
Very much so, because this is just a testament of the hardworking people that they were and are, and the value that they put on working hard to accomplish something that you want to have happen. And so when I see those barbed wire fences, I know that my mom and my dad put those up there, and I have a great respect for the work that they put into that, that they had a vision. They saw this property as something that they could develop. And, you know, I feel very close to them when I'm there on that property.
You're talking about a place that's very close to your heart, of course, and a place that is home. Now, you briefly mentioned how your dad took you all to work overseas in the 70s. Now, describe that. Take a second, because that was in Tehran, right? You lived on the U.S. Embassy compound.
We didn't live on the U.S. Embassy compound, but I graduated from high school on the embassy compound grounds. We actually lived further north in the city, but it was the bicentennial year, so there were a lot of celebrations and things that went on at the embassy grounds, and we were privileged to be a part of that. But it was a huge culture shock going from the rural community in Palestine where we had grown up to a huge city in the Middle East. And it was an adventure, and we addressed it in that way, that this was going to be something that we would do as a family together. It was a unique experience that drew us very close together.
Well, Kathy Wells, your poem describes, and you've described for us so well, what this land means to you, how you'll be buried there yourself, your sister as well. What do you want for this land in the future? You won't be here forever. It'll be up to your children and grandchildren. As you stand here living and breathing, do you want it to stay in the family forever, as they say, or are you, what plans do you have for it?
Well, of course, we want it to stay in the family for as long as possible, for forever. We are proud of the fact that our parents made this available so that no matter what, we know that, that we have a place that we can go, we could build a home, we can spend time on. So yes, I would like for it to stay in the family. I would expect that just as I go and visit my mom and will eventually visit my dad there, that my children will come and visit me.
Well, Kathy Wells, thank you for sharing your work with us.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
Kathy Wells listens to The Takeaway from Palestine, Texas. Her poem was featured as part of our This Is Where project in collaboration with the annual O Miami celebrations at our member station, WLRN, in Miami. To participate, write a short poem describing the place that's important to you and include the hashtag This Is Where, all one word. If you're in South Florida, you can tweet it at WLRN. If you live elsewhere, tweet it to us at The Takeaway, or you can always give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE. This is The Takeaway. Todd Zwillick with you, filling in for John Hockenberry today. Sherpas have led Western climbers through the treacherous Himalaya since the late 19th century, but the practice was cemented in our modern memories when Sir Edmund Hillary summited Mount Everest on May 29th, 1953. Listen.
Just 35 miles from Kathmandu, capital of Nepal, Hillary and Tenzing were welcomed and congratulated by their fellow members of the expedition.
Now, Hillary climbed the peak with Sherpa guide Tenzing Norgay, and according to Hillary, the two men became very close during the climb.
Tenzing and I had been climbing together a good deal, and I think we've become a fairly happy pair.
Well, today, the Sherpa community is mourning after an avalanche killed at least 13 of the guides on Mount Everest last Friday. Crisis talks are expected tomorrow to decide whether the Sherpa community will go back to work. If they choose to stop, it will effectively shut down the entire Everest climbing operation for the rest of this year. Now, that would deal a serious blow for the economy in Nepal, and this moment calls into question the future of the climbing culture that's developed there since Sir Edmund Hillary made his maiden climb with Tenzing Norgay. Peter Athens has worked with the Sherpas since the 1980s. He's climbed Everest 7 times and produces documentaries for National Geographic and PBS. He also runs a climbing school for Sherpas in Nepal. Hi, Peter.
Hello, Todd. How are you today?
I'm well, thanks. Also on the line, Alan Arnett, a longtime mountaineer who has climbed Everest just 4 times. Hi, Alan.
Hi, Todd.
Peter, let me start with you. You've been working with Sherpas for an awfully long time. You both have. It's a horrific thing that happened, the avalanche, and at least 13 dead. But it's not a first in the sense that it's not the first time either climbers or Sherpas have perished on the mountain. What's different now?
Todd, what's changed at this point was just the sheer numbers of people involved in this incredible tragedy and the fact that no amount of training, no amount of physical strength or skill could prevent it from happening. It happened early in the morning. It happened at a time when people normally do go through the ice fall. It was early in the expedition season, so there's a lot of momentum to move people up to start to establish the upper mountain. There was a problem in the ice fall moving people through quickly, and there was a backup behind several ladders. And unfortunately, in an area that's notorious for collapsing, a major collapse took place.
But now we're at a moment, of course, Peter Athens, where Sherpas are, if not officially on strike, refusing to go back to work. They're in talks with the government and with others. So that suggests that in the minds of that community, there's something fundamentally different about this, not just the numbers, but something different about the way they're being treated or safety precautions. What's different?
What's different in this day and age is that as Sherpa skills have improved, there's also been a commensurate disproportionate amount of risk that they've accepted by putting themselves in harm's way so much more frequently than any Western climbers. When I first started going to Everest back in the 80s, it was more typical that climbers would help to actually fix the ice fall, maintain the ice fall route in the upper mountain. Sherpas worked in some of those capacities, but they also worked primarily to help logistically and to carry supplies on the mountain. In this day and age now, Sherpas are doing everything from fixing the route to guiding people on the mountain, and obviously everything in between.
Alan Arnett, can you bring us inside the relationship a little bit between Western climbers and Sherpas? Is it sort of a straight-up economic relationship? Is it closer than that?
Oh, I think it's much closer than that. You know, I can just speak from my own personal experience because I've been over to Nepal probably 10 times and most of those climbing with Sherpa. And, you know, in the beginning, it's a typical relationship that you have to get to know one another. But pretty soon you realize that there's two things going on. Number one is that it's clearly a job. I remember talking with my Sherpa Kami that I summited with in 2011, and we were standing up above Camp 2, and Peter knows exactly what I'm talking about, and Pete does, and this beautiful scene. And I said, Kami, look at this beautiful scene, and what do you think when you see it? And he just shrugged his shoulders and said, it's a job. You know, but also he had, four children, and two of his daughters were in boarding school in Kathmandu. So it was very important for him to, to be able to support that. Many Sherpas used their income to build tea houses, to provide a foundation, not only for their direct family, but also the extended family. But, you know, the relationship goes much deeper with that with me and many, many, many Western clients that you learn to trust each other. You literally, again, as Pete said, they do so much for the Western climbers. My estimate is, and I'll put myself in this 99.9%, that you cannot summit Everest without the support of Sherpas for a normal person like me, you know, just somebody that's got a job and has a lifelong dream and goes there. So the amount of support they give you, the relationship that you develop, the level of trust, it truly goes from just being a transaction into a long-term relationship.
Peter Athens, Alan Arnett says that his Sherpa shrugs and says it's a job, but it also goes deeper. I mean, we get that, but as a job also, it sounds like the Sherpas now want what everybody else wants from their job, which is a level of protection from the government. I don't know if labor standards is even the right way to think about it if you're climbing Mount Everest in such dangerous conditions.
I believe that the increment that can be made right now, obviously, is trying to ensure that they have some adequate protections in place that will help the survivors of an incredible accident like this. We're talking about increasing any type of disability payments, death benefits, so ways that the families can expect some type of support if their main breadwinner, if their father, sons, brothers are out of the picture as a result of taking on this inordinate amount of risk.
I mean, the average Sherpa doesn't have life insurance, I take it.
They have a type of life insurance, but the truth of the matter is that the payouts that are currently in place are really insufficient to cover burial costs, cremation costs, blessing ceremonies that need to take on the anniversary of the event for another 10 years. So it's really not a survivor benefit.
Alan Arnett, before we let you go, as a climber, as somebody who wants to go back to climb, would you be willing to sacrifice a climbing season for your sport if it meant better treatment, better benefits for the Sherpas?
Absolutely. If it was a long-term decision that enabled the entire climbing community to climb safer and to provide that long-term support for the Sherpa, yeah, absolutely. And I think that most of the people at Everest Base Camp today is in that same feeling. You know, there is not an environment of animosity from what I can tell. The emotion is from the Sherpa are more towards the Nepalese government and the amount of money they get from the permits in the neighborhood of $3 million. And most Sherpas will range anywhere from 2,000 to maybe up to 10,000, the very top, depending upon summit bonuses. But they're getting a small part of that. And if they die, then their family is really left uncared for the rest. Other people have to take over.
Peter Athens and Alan Arnett are both longtime mountaineers, have both reached the summit of Mount Everest several times with the help and in the partnership of Sherpas. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity, Todd.
Well, earlier this hour, we asked you if voting could be made easier. What would get you down to the ballot box? From Colorado Springs, we got this. We should do this. Electronic voting by social security number. I know how people would be afraid of voter fraud, but it's simple to have a database. The votes cast with IDs, we can match.
This is Erin calling from Boston, Massachusetts. I don't think people don't vote because it's difficult. I think people don't vote because they don't think it means anything. So we have to find a way to make it more significant to people and let them know that it does matter.
Give us a call at 877-8-MY-TAKE with your take. You can leave a comment on this story or anything you hear at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.